Also, Andy was a model prisoner. Quiet, well-spoken, respectful, non-violent. It's the crazies and the stampeders that get their cells turned upside down at least once every 6 months, their mattresses unzipped, their pillows taken away and cut open, the outflow pipe from their toilets carefully probed. Then, in 1950, Andy became something more than a model prisoner. In 1950, he became a valuable commodity, a murderer who did tax returns better than H&R Block. He gave gratis estate planning advice, set up tax shelters, filled out loan applications, sometimes creatively. I can remember him sitting behind his desk in the library, patiently going over a car loan agreement paragraph by paragraph with a screwhead who wanted to buy a used DeSoto, telling the guy what was good about the agreement and what was bad about it, explaining to him that it was possible to shop for a loan and not get hit quite so bad, steering him away from the finance companies, which in those days were sometimes little better than legal loan sharks. When he'd finished, the screwhead started to put out his hand, and then drew it back to himself quickly. He'd forgotten for a moment, you see, that he was dealing with a mascot, not a man. Andy kept up on the tax laws and the changes in the stock market, and so his usefulness didn't end after he'd been in cold storage for a while, as it might have done. He began to get his library money. His running war with the sisters had ended, and nobody tossed his cell very hard. He was a good nigger. Then one day, very late in the going, perhaps around October of 1967, the long-time hobby suddenly turned into something else. One night, while he was in the hole up to his waist with Raquel Welch hanging down over his ass, the pick end of his rock hammer must have suddenly sunk into concrete past the hilt. He would have dragged some chunks of concrete back, but maybe he heard others falling down into that shaft, bouncing back and forth, clinking off that standpipe. Did he know by then that he was going to come upon that shaft, or was he totally surprised? I don't know. He might have seen the prison blueprints by then, or he might not have. If not, you can be damned sure he found a way to look at them not long after. All at once, he must have realized that instead of just playing a game, he was playing for high stakes. In terms of his own life and his own future, the highest. Even then, he couldn't have known for sure, but he must have had a pretty good idea, because it was right around then that he talked to me about Zihuatanejo for the first time. All of a sudden, instead of just being a toy, that stupid hole in the wall became his master. If he knew about the sewer pipe at the bottom and that it led under the outer wall, it did, anyway. He'd had the key under the rock in Buxton to worry about for years. Now he had to worry that some eager beaver new guard would look behind his poster and expose the whole thing, or that he would get another cellmate, or that he would, after all those years, suddenly be transferred. He had all those things on his mind for the next 8 years. All I can say is that he must have been one of the coolest men who ever lived. I would have gone completely nuts after a while, living with all that uncertainty. But Andy just went on playing the game. He had to carry the possibility of discovery for another 8 years. The probability of it, you might say, because no matter how carefully he stacked the cards in his favor, as an inmate of a state prison, he just didn't have that many to stack. And the guards had been kind to him for a very long time, some 19 years. The most ghastly irony I can think of would have been if he had been offered a parole. Can you imagine it? 3 days before the parolee is actually released, he is transferred into the light security wing to undergo a complete physical and a battery of vocational tests. While he's there, his old cell is completely cleaned out. Instead of getting his parole, Andy would have gotten a long turn downstairs in solitary, followed by some more time upstairs, but in a different cell. If he broke into the shaft in 1967, how come he didn't escape until 1975? I don't know for sure, but I can advance some pretty good guesses. First, he would have become more careful than ever. He was too smart to just push ahead at flank speed and try to get out in 8 months, or even in 18. He must have gone on widening the opening on the crawl space a little at a time, A hole as big as a teacup by the time he took his New Year's Eve drink that year. A hole as big as a dinner plate by the time he took his birthday drink in 1968. As big as a serving tray by the time the 1969 baseball season opened. For a time, I thought it should have gone much faster than it apparently did. After he broke through, I mean. It seemed to me that instead of having to pulverize the crap and take it out of his cell in the cheetah gadgets I have described, he could simply let it drop down the shaft. The length of time he took makes me believe that he didn't dare do that. He might have decided that the noise would arouse someone's suspicions. Or, if he knew about the sewer pipe, as I believe he must have, he would have been afraid that a falling chunk of concrete would break it before he was ready, screwing up the cell block sewage system and leading to an investigation. And an investigation, needless to say, would lead to ruin. Still and all, I'd guess that by the time Nixon was sworn in for his second term, the hole would have been wide enough for him to wriggle through, and probably sooner than that, and he was a small guy. Why didn't he go, then? That's where my educated guesses run out, folks. From this point, they become progressively wilder. One possibility is that the crawl space itself was clogged with crap and he had to clear it out, but that wouldn't account for all the time. So what was it? I think that maybe Andy got scared. I've told you, as well as I can, how it is to be an institutional man. At first you can't stand those four walls. Then you get so you can abide them. Then you get so you accept them. And then, as your body and your mind and your spirit adjust to life on an HO scale, you get to love them. You're told when to eat, when you can write letters, when you can smoke. If you're at work in the laundry or the plate shop, you're assigned 5 minutes of each hour when you can go to the bathroom. For 35 years, my time was 25 minutes after the hour, and after 35 years, that's the only time I ever felt the need to take a piss or have a crap. 25 minutes past the hour. And if for some reason I couldn't go, the need would pass at 30 after, and come back at 25 past the next hour. I think Andy may have been wrestling with that tiger, that institutional syndrome, and also with the bulking fears that all of it might have been for nothing. How many nights must he have lain awake under his poster thinking about that sewer line, knowing the one chance was all he'd ever get? The blueprints might have told him how big the pipe's bore was, but a blueprint couldn't tell him what it would be like inside that pipe. If he would be able to breathe without choking, if the rats were big enough and mean enough to fight instead of retreating, and a blueprint couldn't have told him what he'd find at the end of the pipe when and if he got there. Here's a joke even funnier than the parole would have been. Andy breaks into the sewer line, crawls through 500 yards of choking, shit-smelling darkness, and comes up against a heavy-gauge mesh screen at the end of it all. Ha ha, very funny. That would have been on his mind. And if the long shot actually came in and he was able to get out, would he be able to get some civilian clothes and get away from the vicinity of the prison undetected? Last of all, suppose he got out of the pipe, got away from Shawshank before the alarm was raised, got to Buxton, overturned the right rock, and found nothing beneath. Not necessarily something so dramatic as arriving at the right field and discovering that a high-rise apartment building had been erected on the spot, or that it had been turned into a supermarket parking lot. It could have been that some little kid who liked rocks noticed that piece of volcanic glass, turned it over, saw the deposit box key, and took both it and the rock back to his room as souvenirs. Maybe a November hunter kicked the rock, left the key exposed, and a squirrel or a crow with a liking for bright, shiny things had taken it away. Maybe there had been spring floods one year, breaching the wall, washing the key away. Maybe anything. So I think, wild guess or not, that Andy just froze in place for a while. After all, you can't lose if you don't bet. What did he have to lose, you ask? His library, for one thing, the poisoned peace of institutional life for another, any future chance to grab his safe identity. But he finally did it, just as I have told you. He tried, and my, didn't he succeed in spectacular fashion, you tell me. But did he get away, you ask? What happened after? What happened when he got to that meadow and turned over that rock, always assuming the rock was still there? I can't describe that scene for you, because this institutional man is still in this institution and expects to be for years to come. But I'll tell you this. Very late in the summer of 1975, on September 15th to be exact, I got a postcard which had been mailed from the tiny town of McNary, Texas. That town is on the American side of the border, directly across from El Porvenir. The message side of the card was totally blank. But I know. I know it in my heart as surely as I know that we're all going to die someday. McNary was where he crossed. McNary, Texas. So, that's my story, Jack. I never believed how long it would take to write it all down, or how many pages it would take. I started writing just after I got that postcard, and here I am finishing up on January 14th, 1976. I've used 3 pencils right down to knuckle stubs and a whole tablet of paper. I've kept the pages carefully hidden, not that many could read my hen tracks anyway. It stirred up more memories than I ever would have believed. Writing about yourself seems to be a lot like sticking a branch into clear river water and roiling up the muddy bottom. Well, you weren't writing about yourself, I hear someone in the peanut gallery saying. You were writing about Andy Dufresne. You're nothing but a minor character in your own story. But, you know, that's just not so. It's all about me, every damned word of it. Andy was the part of me they could never lock up, the part of me that will rejoice when the gates finally open for me and I walk out in my cheap suit with my $20 of mad money in my pocket. That part of me will rejoice no matter how old and broken and scared the rest of me is. I guess it's just that Andy had more of that part than me, and used it better. There are others here like me, others who remember Andy. We're glad he's gone, but a little sad, too. Some birds are not meant to be caged, that's all. Their feathers are too bright, their songs too sweet and wild. So you let them go. Or when you open the cage to feed them, they somehow fly out past you. And the part of you that knows it was wrong to imprison them in the first place rejoices, but still the place where you live is that much more drab and empty for their departure. That's the story, and I'm glad I told it, even if it is a bit inconclusive, and even though some of the memories the pencil prodded up like that branch poking up the river mud made me feel a little sad and even older than I am. Thank you for listening. And Andy, if you're really down there, as I believe you are, look at the stars for me just after sunset, and touch the sand, and wade in the water, and feel free. I never expected to take up this narrative again, but here I am with the dog-eared folded pages open on the desk in front of me. Here I am adding another 3 or 4 pages, writing in a brand new tablet, a tablet I bought in a store. I just walked into a store on Portland's Congress Street and bought it. I thought I had put finish to my story in a Shawshank prison cell on a bleak January day in 1976. Now it's May of 1977, and I am sitting in a small, cheap room of the Brewster Hotel in Portland, adding to it. The window is open, and the sound of the traffic floating in seems huge, exciting, and intimidating. I have to look constantly over at the window and reassure myself that there are no bars on it. I sleep poorly at night because the bed in this room, as cheap as the room is, seems much too big and luxurious. I snap awake every morning promptly at 6:30, feeling disoriented and frightened. My dreams are bad. I have a crazy feeling of free fall. The sensation is as terrifying as it is exhilarating. What has happened in my life? Can't you guess? I was paroled. After 38 years of routine hearings and routine denials, in the course of those 38 years, 3 lawyers died on me. My parole was granted. I suppose they decided that at the age of 58 I was finally used up enough to be deemed safe. I came very close to burning the document you have just read. They search outgoing parolees almost as carefully as they search incoming new fish. And beyond containing enough dynamite to assure me of a quick turnaround and another 6 or 8 years inside, my memoirs contain something else, the name of the town where I believe Andy Dufresne to be. Mexican police gladly cooperate with the American police, and I didn't want my freedom or my unwillingness to give up the story I'd worked so long and hard to write to cost Andy his. Then I remembered how Andy had brought in his $500 back in 1948, and I took out my story of him the same way. Just to be on the safe side, I carefully rewrote each page which mentioned Zihuatanejo. If the papers had been found during my outside search, as they call it, at the shank, I would have gone back in on turnaround, but the cops would have been looking for Andy in a Peruvian seacoast town named Las Intrudres. The parole committee got me a job as a stockroom assistant at the big foodway market at the Spruce Mall in South Portland, which means I became just one more aging bag boy. There's only two kinds of bag boys, you know, the old ones and the young ones. No one ever looks at either kind. If you shop at the Spruce Mall foodway, I may have even taken your groceries out of your car, but you'd have had to have shopped there between March and April of 1977, because that's as long as I work there. At first, I didn't think I was going to be able to make it on the outside at all. I've described prison society as a scaled-down model of your outside world, but I had no idea of how fast things moved on the outside, the raw speed people move at. They even talk faster and louder. It was the toughest adjustment I've ever had to make, and I haven't finished making it yet, not by a long way. Women, for instance. After hardly knowing that they were half of the human race for 40 years, I was suddenly working in a store filled with them. Old women, pregnant women, wearing T-shirts with arrows pointing downward and a printed motto reading, "Baby Here." Skinny women with their nipples poking out at their shirts. A woman wearing something like that when I went in would have gotten arrested and then had a sanity hearing. Women of every shape and size. I found myself going around with a semi-hard almost all the time and cursing myself for being a dirty old man. Going to the bathroom, that was another thing. When I had to go, and the urge always came on me at 25 past the hour, I had to fight the almost overwhelming need to check it with my boss. Knowing that was something I could just go and do in this too bright outside world was one thing. Adjusting my inner self to that knowledge after all those years of checking it with the nearest screwhead or facing 2 days in solitary for the oversight, that was something else. My boss didn't like me. He was a young guy, 26 or 27, and I could see that I sort of disgusted him, the way a cringing, servile old dog that crawls up to you on its belly to be petted will disgust a man. Christ, I disgusted myself. But I couldn't make myself stop. I wanted to tell him, "That's what a whole life in prison does for you, young man. It turns everyone in a position of authority into a master, and you into every master's dog. Maybe you know you've become a dog, even in prison, but since everyone else in gray is a dog too, it doesn't seem to matter so much. Outside, it does." But I couldn't tell a young guy like him. He would never understand. Neither would my P.O., a big, bluff ex-Navy man with a huge red beard and a large stock of Polish jokes. He saw me for about 5 minutes every week. "Are you staying out of the bars, Red?" he'd ask when he'd run out of Polish jokes. I'd say, "Yeah," and that would be the end of it until next week. Music on the radio. When I went in, the big bands were just getting up a good head of steam. Now every song sounds like it's about fucking. So many cars. At first I felt like I was taking my life into my hands every time I crossed the street. There was more. Everything was strange and frightening. But maybe you get the idea, or at least can grasp a corner of it. I began to think about doing something to get back in. When you're on parole, almost anything will serve. I'm ashamed to say it, but I began to think about stealing some money or shoplifting stuff from the foodway, anything to get back in where it was quiet and you knew everything that was going to come up in the course of the day. If I had never known Andy, I probably would have done that. But I kept thinking of him, spending all those years chipping patiently away at the cement with his rock hammer so he could be free. I thought of that and it made me ashamed, and I dropped the idea again. Oh, you can say he had more reason to be free than I did. He had a new identity and a lot of money, but that's not really true, you know, because he didn't know for sure that the new identity was still there, and without the new identity, the money would always be out of reach. No, what he needed was just to be free. And if I kicked away what I had, it would be like spitting in the face of everything he had worked so hard to win back. So what I started to do on my time off was to hitchhike rides down to the little town of Buxton. This was in the early April of 1977, the snow just starting to melt off the fields, the air just beginning to be warm, the baseball teams coming north to start a new season, playing the only game I'm sure God approves of. When I went on these trips, I carried a silver compass in my pocket. "There's a big hayfield in Buxton," Andy had said, "and at the north end of that hayfield there's a rock wall, straight out of a Robert Frost poem. And somewhere along the base of that wall is a rock that has no earthly business in a main hayfield." A fool's errand, you say. How many hayfields are there in a small rural town like Buxton? 50? 100? Speaking from personal experience, I'd put it at even higher than that, if you add in the fields now cultivated, which might have been hay grass when Andy went in. And if I did find the right one, I might never know it, because I might overlook that black piece of volcanic glass, or much more likely Andy put it into his pocket and took it with him. So I'd agree with you. A fool's errand, no doubt about it. Worse, a dangerous one for a man on parole, because some of those fields were clearly marked with no trespassing signs, and as I've said, they're more than happy to slam your ass back inside if you get out of line. A fool's errand. But so is chipping at a blank concrete wall for 27 years. And when you're no longer the man who can get it for you and just an old bag boy, it's nice to have a hobby to take your mind off your new life. My hobby was looking for Andy's rock. So I'd hitchhike to Buxton and walk the roads. I'd listen to the birds, to the spring runoff in the culverts, examine the bottles the retreating snows had revealed, all useless, non-returnables, I am sorry to say. The world seems to have gotten awfully spendthrift since I went into the slam and looking for hayfields. Most of them could be eliminated right off. No rock walls. Others had rock walls, but my compass told me they were facing the wrong direction. I walked these wrong ones anyway. It was a comfortable thing to be doing, and on those outings I really felt free, at peace. An old dog walked with me one Saturday, and one day I saw a winter skinny deer. Then came April 23rd, a day I'll not forget even if I live another 58 years. It was a balmy Saturday afternoon, and I was walking up what a little boy fishing from a bridge told me was called the Old Smith Road. I had taken a lunch in a brown foodway bag and had eaten it sitting on a rock by the road. When I was done, I carefully buried my leavings, as my dad taught me before he died, when I was a sprat no older than the fisherman who had named the road for me. Around 2 o'clock, I came to a big field on my left. There was a stone wall at the far end of it running roughly northwest. I walked back to it, squelching over the wet ground, and began to walk the wall. A squirrel scolded me from an oak tree. 3/4 of the way to the end, I saw the rock. No mistake. Black glass and as smooth as silk. A rock with no earthly business in a main hayfield. For a long time I just looked at it, feeling that I might cry for whatever reason. The squirrel had followed me, and it was still chattering away. My heart was beating madly. When I felt I had myself under control, I went to the rock, squatted beside it. The joints in my knees went off like a double-barreled shotgun, and let my hand touch it. It was real. I didn't pick it up because I thought there would be anything under it. I could just as easily have walked away without finding what was beneath. I certainly had no plans to take it away with me because I didn't feel it was mine to take. I had a feeling that taking that rock from the field would have been the worst kind of theft. No, I only picked it up to feel it better, to get the heft of the thing, and I suppose to prove its reality by feeling its satiny texture against my skin. I had to look at what was underneath for a long time. My eyes saw it, but it took a while for my mind to catch up. It was an envelope, carefully wrapped in a plastic bag to keep away the damp. My name was written across the front in Andy's clear script. I took the envelope and left the rock where Andy had left it and Andy's friend before him. Dear Red, if you're reading this, then you're out. One way or another, you're out. And if you've followed along this far, you might be willing to come a little further. I think you remember the name of the town, don't you? I could use a good man to help me get my project on wheels. Meantime, have a drink on me, and do think it over. I will be keeping an eye out for you. Remember that hope is a good thing, Red, maybe the best of things, and no good thing ever dies. I will be hoping that this letter finds you, and finds you well. Your friend, Peter Stevens. I didn't read that letter in the field. A kind of terror had come over me, a need to get away from there before I was seen. To make what may be an appropriate pun, I was in terror of being apprehended. I went back to my room and read it there with the smell of old men's dinners drifting up the stairwell to me. Beefaroni, rice-a-roni, noodle-roni, you can bet that whatever the old folks of America, the ones on fixed incomes, are eating tonight, it almost certainly ends in roni. I opened the envelope and read the letter, and then I put my head in my arms and cried. With the letter, there were 20 new $50 bills. And here I am, in the Brewster Hotel, technically a fugitive from justice again. Parole violation is my crime. No one's going to throw up any roadblocks to catch a criminal wanted on that charge, I guess. Wondering what I should do now. I have this manuscript. I have a small piece of luggage about the size of a doctor's bag that holds everything I own. I have 1950s, 410s, a 5-3-1s, and assorted change. I broke one of the 50s to buy this tablet of paper and a deck of smokes. Wondering what I should do. But there's really no question. It always comes down to just two choices: get busy living or get busy dying. First, I'm going to put this manuscript back in my bag. Then I'm going to buckle it up, grab my coat, go downstairs, and check out of this flea bag. Then I'm going to walk uptown to a bar and put that $5 bill down in front of the bartender and ask him to bring me two straight shots of Jack Daniels, one for me and one for Andy Dufresne. Other than a beer or two, they'll be the first drinks I've taken as a free man since 1938. Then I am going to tip the bartender $1 and thank him kindly. I will leave the bar and walk up Spring Street to the Greyhound terminal there and buy a bus ticket to El Paso by way of New York City. When I get to El Paso, I'm going to buy a ticket to McNary. And when I get to McNary, I guess I'll have a chance to find out if an old crook like me can find a way to float across the border and into Mexico. Sure, I remember the name. Zihuatanejo. A name like that is just too pretty to forget. I find I am excited. So excited I can hardly hold the pencil in my trembling hand. I think it is the excitement that only a free man can feel. A free man starting a long journey whose conclusion is uncertain. I hope Andy is down there. I hope I can make it across the border. I hope to see my friend and shake his hand. I hope the Pacific is as blue as it has been in my dreams. I hope.
The End.